Welcome to this Walnut Wednesday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On this week's Walnut Wednesday, Taylor Charlstrom has a report regarding brand new updates on amid a culprit. And Kylie Harlan reports on a University of California Davis trial looking at weed control by electrocution. I'll have national and regional agricultural news, and I'll begin with regional ag news right after this word from our sponsor.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
A year after coming together to help make the agricultural landscape more friendly to pollinators, members of the California Pollinator Coalition say they're gaining momentum, building stronger relationships between agriculture and conservation groups that are already increasing habitat on the ground. The coalition, created in April of 2021 and including more than 20 agriculture, conservation, and government organizations, says it's building a stronger network among these groups that has already led to new projects to expand on the success of the efforts of its individual member organizations. Thanks to the individual and collective efforts of the coalition members, they've seen a lot of positive developments over the last year, according to Lori Davies Adams of Pollinator Partnership, one of the coalition's founding members. She says the state has also provided $30 million in new funding for pollinator projects, and they've seen more and more projects like cover crops and hedge growers installed among the state's orchards, vineyards, rangelands, and croplands. As the coalition celebrates National Pollinator Week, which is this week, it is assessing the progress its members have helped to spur, which includes more than 65,000 acres of pollinator forage added throughout the state on over 400 farms in the last 18 months. Approximately 340 acres of new and enhanced habitat installed in California for monarch butterflies, with another 40,000 milkweed plants planned this year. $30 million over 2 years earmarked by Governor Gavin Newsom and the legislature for sharing costs and providing incentives for farmers, ranchers, and vineyard managers to create pollinator habitat on working lands, working with researchers to advance guidance of habitat placement on farms and working lands, and new partnerships built that launch current projects, including creating more California-specific guidance for growers and finding new funding. And following up on that story, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has issued a United States Department of Agriculture proclamation in recognition and support of National Pollinator Week. Pollinator species such as bees, other insects, birds, and bats play a critical role in producing more than 100 crops grown in the United States. Honeybee pollination alone adds more than $18 billion in value to agricultural crops annually. USDA recognizes the critical role that pollinators play in agriculture and supports pollinator health through research, data collection, diagnostic services, monitoring, pollinator habitat enhancement programs, and pollinator health investments. USDA also released its annual Strategic Pollinator Priorities Report that outlines USDA pollinator research and programmatic priorities for the coming year. Research priorities focus on both managed and wild pollinators. Identifying pollinator research priorities and practices enables USDA, their partners, and communities they serve to make informed decisions when supporting pollinator health in the agricultural systems, ecosystems, and economies that depend on pollinators. USDA will also be hosting a pollinator exhibits exposition in conjunction with the USDA Farmers Market this Friday, June 24th. It will take place in Washington, D.C. And speaking of USDA, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has announced that the U.S. Department of Agriculture plans to provide up to $200 million in assistance for specialty crop producers who incur eligible on-farm food safety program expenses to obtain or renew a food safety certification in calendar years 2022 or 2023. USDA's new food safety certification for specialty crops program will help to offset costs for specialty crop producers to comply with regulatory requirements and market-driven food safety certification requirements, which is part of USDA's broader effort to transform the food system to create a more level playing field for small and medium producers and a more balanced, equitable economy for everyone working in food and agriculture. Specialty crop operations can apply for assistance for eligible expenses related to a 2022 food safety certificate issued on or after June 21st of 2022, beginning on June 27th. For more information on a certification, contact your local county Farm Service Agency office. Cherries, stone fruit, and melons are nearing their peak, but unfortunately, produce demand is soft and the early summer weather is already sweltering. Production regions in California are practically feverish. A high of 111 degrees is forecasted to scorch Coachella, California this Friday. In light of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics' disheartening inflation news, it is relieving for buyers to see FOB prices soften. But no matter how tasty those California cherries look, dropping $100 to fill the gas tank makes consumers less likely to splurge in a produce section. Blue Book has teamed up with Produce IQ for information. It is an index that provides a produce industry price benchmark using 40 top commodities to provide data for decision-making. Asparagus prices are now up 19% over last week. Mexican growing regions for asparagus are in transition. Baja California and Mexico is winding down, and Central Mexico has yet to pick up production. There is some light supply coming in from Peru. However, cooler weather is lessening those yields. After 2 weeks of what seemed like the beginning of the end to sky-high avocado prices, Mexican and Californian avocados are back up to $80 for a 48 count. Supply is again incredibly short and will probably remain so for a while to come. There was a heat wave on the coast last week that damaged blueberries and blackberries. And before the heat wave, blueberry supply was already thin. Despite the continued shortages and damage to crops in the Central Valley, prices seem to be steadying at their albeit high levels. The Pacific Northwest is still a couple of weeks, however. Other domestic growers in the East Coast have some quality product. Like blueberries, blackberries on the West Coast also suffered damage from the heat, though prices have yet to show any severe reaction. Iceberg and romaine fields suffered some damage. However, unlike berries, prices are responding to the reduced supply. Prices for romaine are up over 4% and iceberg prices are up 14%. Lower demand caused by the closing of schools for summer is softening the market and steadying prices. Some vegetables just don't enjoy summer that much. Broccoli markets are tightening up in response to short supply. Prices are up only 4%, but may climb further in response to warm and wet weather in Mexico and subsequent pest problems. Fortunately, California has plenty of good supply and can pick up any remaining slack.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
With this week's Walnut Wednesday report, here's Taylor Chalstrom.
Pesticide regulations continue to take the California walnut industry by storm, but recent events spur some hope. I caught up with California Walnut Boarding Commission's Josh Rahm at last week's Western Ag Processors Association annual meeting. And he noted an important update on imidacloprid, as well as what the industry needs to know about neonics right now.
As of June 16th, 2022, the DPR director concurred with the favorable ruling on imidacloprid in groundwater. And this is as a result of some groundwater detection, residue levels, very minute at that. But the PREC committee through DPR, the subcommittee found that the presence of imidacloprid in groundwaters of the state is not polluted and does not threaten to pollute the state's groundwaters within the meaning of pollute as defined under the Food and Agriculture Code. And to introduce a pesticide, to quote from that product, into the groundwaters of the state resulting in an active ingredient, other specified ingredient, or a degradation product of a pesticide above a level that does not cause adverse health effects, accounting for an adequate margin of safety. So, quote unquote, there, the favorable ruling was there in favor of imidacloprid not causing any issues based on detections found. And the California Walnut Commission has been engaged and went on record multiple times providing the science-based and practical use information, re-emphasized the importance of the product for integrated pest management and it being a valuable crop protection tool for growers to protect, produce, and preserve the highest quality of walnuts in the world produced in California. We thank the rest of the ag industry, groups that were engaged, the continued collaboration amongst all key stakeholders involved, and appreciate the DPR's decision and support of fact-based and sound science in this regulatory decision. A big win here for California growers.
European Union maximum residue levels also see an update on the imidacloprid front, and neonics, again including imidacloprid, were part of EPA's recent biological evaluation, according to Rahm.
There's been an EU MRL, maximum residue limit or level, officially enacted as of last month at 0.01 parts per million. So with importers, processors, it's important for handlers and growers alike to know that based on the reviews and following label instructions and new levels, they should have minimal impacts. It's also advisable that residue testing should be reviewed and utilized to ensure compliance. So there's the EU MRLs, and also everything seems to be going on at once and comes in threes sometimes. So we see the US EPA has released their three final biological evaluations for neonic insecticides, including imidacloprid again, on popular date, June 16th, so very recently. It's part of the Endangered Species Act evaluation that identifies potential impacts on endangered and threatened species and their critical habitats. So we saw a couple things in the BE summary. Keep in mind some of it's new and just being analyzed, but basically some of the things that I've seen and stakeholders in ag and other additional parties have seen is that the BE uses a conservative approach to model potential adverse effects, which when viewed in isolation could cause public concern about the use of neonics. The EPA has qualified the conservative nature of the BEs in the first page of their executive summary, so that's where some of the excerpts will be highlighted here of importance for industry members to know. And the statement was excerpt from that summary basically saying, practically, the likely adverse effect or LAA threshold for a BE is very conservative, as the likely take of even one individual of a species triggers the LAA, even if that species is almost recovered. So what does that mean, and what are the results of that? This often results in a high number of may affect determinations in a biological evaluation. An LAA determination in the biological evaluation, however, should not be interpreted to mean that EPA has made a determination that imidacloprid is putting a species in jeopardy. Those determinations actually are made in the course of Step 3 by the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, referred to as the quote-unquote services. So the final biological evaluations contain the same conclusions in the draft BEs released back in August of 2021, and based on the conservative models mentioned previously. So again, as of yesterday, now that the neonics are finalized, the BEs are finalized, the EPA is going to revise the proposed interim decisions originally published back in January of 2020 to include mitigations based on the respective BEs and publish for public comment in early 2023. Secondly, they're going to enter into consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service, or FWS, and the National Marine Fisheries Service, where any potential effects are refined to arrive at a conclusion on the actual impacts to endangered species and critical habitat. The services, as mentioned before, will release a biological opinion that makes the jeopardy determination. The draft biological opinion is expected to publish in 23-24, followed by another public comment period and further refinement by the services before finalization. Labels will be amended then based on the conclusions of that final opinion. And then last but not least, working from the final biological evaluations and biological opinion, if available, the EPA will incorporate mitigations, whether that be no spray buffer zones, drift reduction technology, and more. So to the interim decisions, all this correlating, expected in 2024. So following the publication of the interim decisions for the neonics and pesticide registrants, they're going to amend and submit amended labels to incorporate mitigation from both the registration review process. Now, these revised labels with mitigations could, keyword could, be approved and come into force for the 2025 growing season. So that timeline of imidacloprid and other neonic mitigations in the marketplace is really going to be resulting from the EPA interim decision in 2025. So stay tuned. Those dates may change and be adjusted, but the CWC, California Walnut Commission, is going to be engaged on behalf of the ag industry and all growers alike.
More updates on these pesticide regulations to come on future Walnut Wednesday episodes. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Charlstrom.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, working together to advance the industry. Together, we can do more.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
The American Farm Bureau Federation warned the Securities and Exchange Commission on Friday about the consequences to rural America of the SEC's proposed rule, the enhancement and standardization of climate-related disclosures for investors. The proposal would require public companies to report on Scope 3 emissions, which are the result of activities from assets not owned or controlled by a publicly traded company, but contribute to its value chain. While farmers and ranchers would not be required to report directly to the SEC, this regulation would impose additional burdens as they provide almost every raw product that goes into the food supply chain. The comments were filed on behalf of AFBF and 10 other agriculture organizations. The organizations state that the organizations and their members are committed to transparency in climate-related matters to inform their stakeholders in a manner consistent with existing practices in the agriculture industry. However, without change and clarifications, the proposed rules would be widely burdensome and expensive, if not altogether impossible, for many small and mid-sized farmers to comply with. AFBF President Zippy Duvall said that farmers and ranchers are committed to feeding America's families while protecting the resources they've been entrusted with. They're doing this through voluntary market-driven incentives, but this proposed rule threatens that progress. He says that family farms don't have teams of compliance officers and attorneys to respond to Wall Street. Higher costs could keep small farms from doing business with publicly traded companies, which could lead to more consolidation and fewer farmers at a time when the world is increasingly calling on rural America to meet the needs of hungry families. Recommendations to the SEC include removing the value chain concept from the proposed rules, removing or substantially revising of Scope 3 emissions disclosure requirements to include an explicit exemption for the agriculture industry, removing the requirement that registrants provide disclosures pertaining to their climate-related targets and goals, revising the proposed rules so that disclosures of GHG emissions operate in unison with existing federal emissions reporting programs, ensuring the final rules do not include location data disclosures for GHG emissions, which may inadvertently disclose the private information of family farms. Actions are being taken to reduce the global waste of fertilizer and increase fertilizer production. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford has the full story.
At the White House Friday,
Russia's war in Ukraine is worsening food insecurity, in part due to the skyrocketing price of fertilizer.
President Biden telling a virtual International Energy and Climate Forum.
But more than 50% of nitrogen fertilizers are lost globally every year due to waste. So today, the United States is launching a new global fertilizer challenge. Let's aim to raise at least $100 million toward increasing fertilizer efficiency.
And developing alternatives. Earlier in the week, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters at United Nations headquarters.
President Biden has directed the Department of Agriculture to invest up to $500 million looking at new and different ways to use fertilizer and to produce fertilizer, or steps that could be used in lieu of fertilizer in order to continue to increase crop productivity.
Which Vilsack said is an absolute necessity to maintain global food security. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Rail worker unions recently said no to railroad contract proposals after 3 weeks of mediation, following more than 2 years of fruitless negotiations with the National Carriers Conference Committee, which represents Union Pacific, BNSF, CSX, Norfolk Southern, Kansas City Southern, and other railroads. The contract talks involve approximately 140,000 workers who are members of 13 rail unions. Workers are frustrated they have not received raises since 2019, and they want their pay to increase enough to offset inflation, according to union members. Workers are also having to endure increasingly strict attendance policies that BNSF and Union Pacific have imposed. One of the most important issues at hand is railroad proposals to cut rail crews from two people down to one, which is vehemently opposed by workers. After 3 weeks of in-person meetings in Washington, D.C., the National Mediation Board has offered arbitration to rail unions, including the IAM, Transportation Communications Union, and TCUIM, Brotherhood Railway Carmen Division members. As of June 10th, the TCUIAM website noted enough is enough. The only pathway to resolving this dispute is for the NMB to put forth a proffer of arbitration to move the dispute to the final steps of the Railway Labor Act. The Prohibition of Agricultural Land for the People's Republic of China Act would stop China's government from buying up any more American farmland. Bill's sponsor, U.S. Representative Dan Newhouse, a Washington State Republican, says there have been recent developments with regards to China's investments.
There was just a couple weeks ago, a new report that was released by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. And their report deals with this whole topic of China purchasing agricultural interest.
And that report, Newhouse says, raises some questions.
And they state that there truly are concerns here that China, by making these investments in agricultural assets, I think they phrased it as they would have undue leverage over our U.S. supply chain.
Which he says goes beyond simple ag land purchases.
They also talk about, since the United States is a global leader and that China is one of our prime trading partners, we often talk about the importance of strengthening our agricultural sector and our food security.
Newhouse says if you look up what China is doing around the world, what's happening here is not surprising.
They truly are inserting themselves into many different countries, controlling natural resources, critical elements, critical minerals, infrastructures around the globe in Central America and South America, on the African continent, and even in Asia. We're starting to see that here in the United States by their involvement in acquiring agricultural assets.
So Newhouse says this bill might be at least part of the answer.
With my legislation, I think it's a great first step that we should be taking to try to get a handle on this, so that we don't wake up one day in the future, 5, 10, 20 years from now, and wish that we had taken action sooner.
Newhouse says this is something that should be done preventively now.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
And now with more information about a University of California Davis trial looking at weed control by electrocution, here's Kylie Harlan with a report.
When thinking about non-chemical weed control, many people just think about traditional physical methods such as tillage and mowing. However, an alternative method, electric weed control, is currently being investigated by a team at UC Davis. Brad Hansen, Cooperative Extension Weed Science Specialist at UC Davis, explains more on how this new weed control method actually works.
What we're looking at is a weed control device. It's an electrical weed control device, which basically means it's a non-chemical weed control practice. So this is our first impression of an electrical weeder that we purchased and are using in a research project that's funded by the USDA Organic Research and Extension Initiative. The weed control device works like many thermal weeders. So it's actually not the electricity that's killing the weed. It's heat generated by electricity passing through the plant. So the applicator essentially is a big generator with a transformer mounted on the tractor to turn PTO, you know, horsepower into electrical energy. It passes the current into the plant through a positive electrode mounted on a applicator bar. And then it has a set of springs that are touching the soil. So basically the electricity passes through the upper part of the plant into the root of the plant and out into the soil and closes the circuit
Hansen's team includes researchers from Oregon State University and Cornell University. Each university is looking into how electric weed control can affect tree nut and berry production.
We're just getting started on this research. This was a project funded by the USDA OREI program. It's a three-year project. I've got a student who is a PhD student who will be working on this for his project. Tong Zhen is a Horton Agronomy student at UC Davis, will be working on this for the next several years. So essentially all we've done to date is take possession of the electrical weeder. This is a device that was built in Brazil. So it took several months to have it built and imported. And then we've only demonstrated it and done some practice runs with it on campus in a couple of orchards and in some fallowed fields with weeds. Over the next few years, we'll be focused at Davis on tree nuts, primarily almonds, organic, and organic blueberry production. This project is a collaborative project with Cornell University and Oregon State University. And our collaborators at Oregon State will be working on hazelnuts as their tree crop, along with blueberries. And the collaborators at Cornell will be working on apples and blueberries. So we'll be kind of looking at a lot of different production systems in three different regions of the country with important perennial crop systems.
Based off of first impressions, this method looks to be fairly promising. Hansen shares more about what they have seen so far when using electric weed control.
So my program over the years has been primarily a chemical weed control program. I have not done a lot of organic work and very little work with weed control devices. So I was, open, but maybe a little bit skeptical. So in our initial run of this machine, after we got it, set up and operable on one of our tractors, it's a very rapid action on some weeds. So there was a field that had a large patch of a field bindweed, a difficult perennial weed. When we tested it on that site, really within a few minutes, that the field bindweed looked kind of sick. The tops were very wilted. And within an hour or a couple hours, they were basically dried and crispy. Now, I will say on field bindweed, that's the tops that are controlled. I doubt we did a significant amount of damage to that extensive root system, but the activity was very rapid on the above ground tissue. We did another test a few days or weeks later on some several different fields with different weed spectra. And again, I was quite impressed. The smaller plants, the site we had that had red root pigweed and other pigweeds and purslane, very, very rapid activity and quite complete control on those small annual plants. We had another field that had more established hairy fleabane, which is it was larger and kind of hardened off at that time of the year. And it also did a pretty good job on those plants, although I think because of their size, that might take two applications to kill some of those large established hard plants.
While the initial results are promising, Hansen said there are still some things that need to be considered in order to determine if this is a truly viable weed control option. These items will help the team determine what comes next in their research.
Electricity and heat will definitely kill weeds. That's not, a earth-shattering bit of science. But I think for us in California, there's going to be lots of questions about how can we best use it, mostly related to soil water status and plant water status, because you can imagine the more wet, more moisture containing plants will conduct electricity better and probably get hotter as the electricity is conducted through them. It likely would be controlled better. So well-watered conditions would make the plants well-watered. On the other side, moist soil would probably dissipate the electricity more quickly out of the root and into the soil. And so it may limit the activity on the below ground part of the plant. So I think a lot of what we're going to be looking at is how does it work on different weed species that are relevant to California orchards and blueberry systems, grasses and broadleaves and perennial plants. How does it work in our various types of irrigation systems, and what sort of irrigation management might you want to have to facilitate good weed control with the electrical weeder? And then, you know, lastly, there's just questions of how fast can you drive it? How much energy does it take? What's the economics of this versus other organic practices? And I should also say, there's two of us at UC Davis that are part of this project. I'm in the weed science end of things, and we've got a collaborator in the agricultural research, resource economics, an ag economist who will be working on this project as well, providing economic support for all three of the universities.
In the future, electric weed control may be an interesting and effective option for producers. Hansen and his team are eager to see the result of the study in the coming years.
A lot of these devices, whether they're electrical weeders like this one or a thermal weeder, such as a hot air weeder or a flamer or something, you know, they're often fairly slow operations. So that's going to be part of this, you know, the cost of the labor and the cost of the equipment and the cost of the fuel. These are high horsepower requiring, machines. Our particular weeder requires about 100 horsepower tractor. So it's got a carbon footprint, I would say, because of the fuel costs and the current fuel prices. Of course, that's even maybe more upfront. I think it's going to be a very interesting research opportunity to figure out where this fits into our weed control strategies and maybe where it doesn't. One thing I will say with any of the thermal devices, this electrical weeder included, there is some risk of fire. So I actually, my sense of this is it's probably going to be more of a fall, winter, spring application and maybe less so during the drier times of the year when there's dry vegetation. With the blueberry part of the project, I would say we'll have some questions about how the mulch is affected or not affected by the physical activity of the applicator bar or the electricity or the heat generated. So there's just a lot of interesting pieces of this that are going to be specific to how these crops are grown in California.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.